Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Children's Justice Project monthly training series. This training is offered to key stakeholders involved in Wyoming's juvenile court system and held every second Tuesday of the month from 12 to 1 p.m. To obtain the materials electronically for today's training, please visit the Children's Justice Project website at www.courts.state.wy.us/initiatives/CJP and then click the training tab in the middle of the screen. If there are any questions, participants are welcome to call in during the last 10 minutes of the training session. The call-in number is area code 917-889-8064. One may also post questions and comments using the online chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. We hope you'll find today's training informative and would like to thank you for your attendance.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our April Blog Talk Radio session. The session today is called 2016-2017 Wyoming Child Welfare Law Update, Wyoming Supreme Court Decisions and Changes to Statutes. My name is Edie Troutwine, and I am the Children's Justice Project Coordinator here at the Wyoming Supreme Court. And it is my pleasure to introduce today's speakers. We have Jill Kachera, who is a Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Wyoming Attorney General's Office, as well as Christina McCabe from the Attorney General's Office. They are going to provide a review of recent Wyoming Supreme Court decisions from 2016 and 2017 related to child welfare. They will also provide an overview of statutory changes from the recent legislative session that affect Wyoming children and families. The handout for today's presentation can be downloaded off of the CJP website, and the handout is titled Juvenile Court Law Update 2004 through 2017. This is a publication that CJP routinely updates, and it includes legislative updates and case summaries of recent Wyoming Supreme Court decisions related more specifically to Title 14 actions. These ladies have a lot to get through today, so without further ado, I will turn it over to Jill and Christina.
Thank you, Edie. We would like to approach this by talking about, first about the legislative changes from the 2017 general session, and then talking about the case law from 2016 and 2017. And we probably will be talking pretty quickly because there are five pieces of legislation and nine cases that we need to get through. We've kind of seen a little bit of an upswing in appeals in this area in the last few years, and so quite a bit more case law than normally we would have to report on. I will talk about the legislation, and then Christina and I will kind of go back and forth with respect to the case law. So the first piece of legislation is House Bill 0018, which is Enrolled Act Number 3. It relates to the Department of Family Services making efforts to determine if a parent of a child in a child abuse, suspected child abuse or neglect case, is a member of the armed forces, or if a child is enrolled in the defense enrollment eligibility reporting system. So there are changes to Wyoming Statute 14.3203, 204, and 206 to cover those areas. The legislation also provides that if there is a determination that a parent of a child is a member of the armed forces or the child is enrolled in the defense enrollment eligibility reporting system, that the department would provide information to the state judge advocate for the Wyoming Military Department as to that report of abuse and neglect. And that bill is effective July 1st, so not in effect yet. The second piece of legislation is House Bill 0041, Enrolled Act Number 58. This just made some minor changes to Wyoming Statute 2113.315, which is what we call the court order placement statute found in the Education Code. But it just kind of changed the ages of children who are subject to the act from 6 years of age to 5 years of age, and then from 18 years of age to 21 years of age, and also added references to Wyoming Statute 14.6.427 within the act. This piece of legislation is also effective July 1st of 2017. The third piece of legislation is House Bill 0153, Enrolled Act Number 96. It adds a provision to Wyoming Statute, to Title 14. The provision is 14.2206, headed Protection of Parental Rights. And in my mind, this piece of legislation just puts down in our statutes what has been the law and what remains to be the law, that parental rights is the right of a parent to have the care and custody of their child is a fundamental right, and that it can't be infringed upon without a compelling state interest. From my opinion, this piece of legislation doesn't really add anything in that it was already by case law and the way that cases have been dealt with the law of our state. Again, this legislation is effective July 1st, 2017. The next piece of legislation is House Bill 0159, which is Enrolled Act Number 109. This also creates provisions in Title 14, right at the beginning of Title 14, 14.1.102. It pertains to unemancipated and homeless minors and allows an unemancipated minor to obtain a birth certificate, enter into a contract for housing, employment, or purchase of a motor vehicle, or establishing a bank account, those types of things, if that particular minor meets certain requirements. Those are that the minor is 16 years of age, that the minor is willingly living separate and apart from his parents, and his parents consent to or acquiesce in that separate living arrangement, that the minor is homeless, managing his own affairs, and the minor, in order to have this provision apply, has to submit a notarized affidavit setting out that he meets all of those requirements. The affidavit has to be witnessed by two or more adults, and the statute specifically says who those adults can be, so an attorney, a healthcare provider, a rabbi, a priest, a minister, clergy or other religious counselor, or a college or school administrator or counselor. So it can't just be that the kid finds somebody over the age of 18 and asks them to witness this affidavit. And then it also adds a provision to the reporting requirements for abuse and neglect and states that the fact that a child who is at least 16 years of age is homeless, as defined in this new section, shall not in and of itself constitute a sufficient basis for reporting neglect. This is a little bit concerning in that these kids may lie on these affidavits, those type of things, but it is now new legislation. Again, it's effective July 1st, 2017. The final piece of legislation is Senate File 0063, which is Enrolled Act Number 43, and this was just a general cleanup statute relating to some Department of Family Services statutes, but does change and kind of clean up and clarify some of the provisions relating to confidentiality of records and application for a central registry check. And so it clarifies who can apply for a central registry check. It allows an agent on behalf of the applicant to submit the application for a central registry check. It allows a person to request a central registry check on themselves. And then just all of those are in Title 14, but then the legislation also addresses provisions in the Adult Protective Services Act to make the provisions relating to the Central Registry in both the Child Protection Act and the Adult Protective Services Act be consistent with one another. So those, and that piece of legislation, again, is effective July 1st, 2017. So those are the new areas of the law that kind of are going to affect kids and families. Now we'll move to the case law from 2016 and 2017, and Christina will be talking about the first case.
Okay, so the first one from 2016 that we want to talk with you guys about today is in the interest of CRA. It's 2016 Wyoming 24. It was issued in February of 2016. And just a little basic rundown of the facts for you. This case is an appeal that stems from a juvenile neglect proceeding. The basis of that juvenile proceeding involved a child being removed from the mother's care and custody and being placed with her maternal grandmother. There was a consent decree entered into that with mom to address the neglect allegations. The father was also involved to varying extents in the juvenile case and also signed off on and was a party to the consent decree with the mother. As part of the proceedings, there was a permanency order that ultimately continued custody of the minor child with DFS and continued the placement with the minor child's maternal grandmother. However, ultimately, the county attorney's office did file a motion to dismiss the case based on mother's compliance with the consent decree, and the case was, and the juvenile court did dismiss the case. And so this appeal is actually taken by the father of the minor child, and the issues that the father raised to the appellate court, number one, related to whether or not did the juvenile court err when it granted that the state's motion to dismiss without a hearing or without making any findings about mom's completion of the consent decree requirements. And then there are some additional issues raised by the father relating to whether or not the court was required to determine if father was unfit prior to placing the minor child with the maternal grandmother instead of with the father. And so the court does start out its discussion and analysis with the county, with the state's motion to dismiss the juvenile case, which ultimately would then vacate the temporary custody that the department had. And so in answering that question as to whether or not the juvenile court needed to have a hearing, whether or not they needed to make findings that the mother had complied with the consent decree, the court did, of course, look at statutory interpretation and its specific application in this case. And in looking at that, the court looked at the consent decree provisions found in Title 14 at 14.3.4.28 and noted that the statute, as it relates to consent decrees, requires hearings in only two circumstances. The first being that when the child, when there's a consent decree and the child is in placement, there should be review hearings. And then the second hearing that is recognized to be held when a consent decree is in place is when the state would move to reinstate the original petition for failure of the parent or guardian to fulfill the terms of the consent decree. The court noted that the statute doesn't require any other hearings and did sort of highlight again some of the requirements of a consent decree, which it can't be entered into without the agreement of the district or county attorney, the child's guardian ad litem, and the parents. But there's also no requirement that there be a hearing to create a consent decree, which takes us back to the previous determination by our court that consent decrees are contractual agreements, contracts entered into and made by the parties. And because of that, the court then would employ contract principles in interpreting the consent decree and how it should be interpreted. The court also noted again as a particular point with regard to the state moving to dismiss the action is that the consent decree can either end by expiration of its term or by discharge of the court. And that was important to the court because, again, looking at the plain language of that statute, there is, again, no requirement that the court conduct a hearing or make a finding before a consent decree can expire by either of those two means. And so the court did decline to interpret the statute as requiring a hearing prior to the juvenile court discharging the mother, relying again on the plain language that the statute does not include such a requirement, and the statute does not require any court findings prior to discharge. So with regard to father's assertion that there should have been a hearing, and in conjunction with that, there should have been a hearing to determine conclusively whether or not mom had completed the requirements of her consent decree, that there was no requirement for that. And building a little bit more on the father's argument that there should have been a hearing to determine whether mom had complied with the consent decree requirements, the court noted that as a practical point, you know, such a hearing in this case, it would be meaningless because in our juvenile proceedings, the county attorney is the one who would decide whether to continue to prosecute the neglect case. And so if a hearing were to have been held and the court to find that the mother had not complied with the consent decree, under our statutes, the court could not then force the county attorney to pursue the neglect action. And so, again, the court just made it clear through this opinion that under our Child Protection Act, the district attorney or county attorney has the sole discretion to determine whether to pursue a neglect action. So, of course, just boiling down to, you know, there was no necessity for a hearing to be held on the county attorney's motion to dismiss, and there was no requirement that there be some type of evidentiary hearing to determine whether or not the mother had complied with the requirements of the case plan, and that those determinations would be up to the county attorney. The opinion does go a little further into, again, looking at the consent decree and reinforcing and discussing those contract principles that were previously set out in the MR case. And the father in this case did recognize that the consent decree was a contractual agreement and that it was going to be enforced as a contract. And part of the contract that the father agreed to did indicate that if prior to expiration of the decree, the mother failed to fulfill the term, the original proceedings could be reinstated, but the contract clearly said that that was at the county attorney's discretion. So again, the consent decree itself, the language of the consent decree, continued to support the court's determination that there was not a need or requirement for a hearing. And so the Supreme Court did find that the juvenile court properly discharged the mother from the consent decree in this case. Now, there were some other issues raised by the appellant, which related to the placement of custody with the father and whether or not he needed to be determined to be unfit before the child could be placed with anyone else. And in this appeal, the state and the guardian ad litem did support a finding by the Supreme Court that those issues were moot at that time in the proceedings, given that the juvenile case had been dismissed and was completely closed. What the opinion does, the Supreme Court did review the additional issues under the mootness doctrine, did find them to be moot, however, went through a thorough discussion of the three exceptions to the mootness doctrine, provided a good discussion of each of those exceptions, and ultimately, again, found that none of those exceptions applied. And so in applying the mootness doctrine to a juvenile case, this opinion does provide a very good roadmap of each, again, of the mootness doctrine and of each of the three exceptions in the case. And so ultimately, the determination, again, was that the consent decree controlled the situation with this family. The father was a party to the consent decree, and as it related to placement with placement of the minor child with the father, the part of the consent decree that he agreed to indicated that placement of the child would be with the maternal grandmother while the Department of Family Services worked family reunification with the mother. So as part of his contractual agreement under the consent decree, he had already agreed that this placement was appropriate. And so based on the contract principles, there was nothing left for the court to interpret as it related to his position on placement with the child. And so that was a pretty long case, but it does kind of reinforce the contract principles as it relates to consent decrees, as well as providing application of the mootness doctrine and its exceptions in a juvenile setting. And the next case that we have, Jill is going to talk to you about.
Okay. So this is in the matter of the termination of parental rights to HLL and KGS. The site is 2016, Wyoming 43. This decision came out in April of 2016. It is an appeal from a default hearing in a termination of parental rights case. And one of the main issues in the case had to do with whether the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure, and specifically Wyoming Rule of Civil Procedure 55 governing default, applies to termination proceedings. Just briefly, factual background, this is a case where two children came into care after significant neglect and abuse from the mother. And later we'll talk about a companion case relating to a termination on the father of one of these children. But this particular appeal relates to the termination against the mother. The department filed the petition for termination of parental rights. Mother was incarcerated in Lusk the petition was personally served on her. She did not answer the petition, and default was entered by the clerk against her, and the court set the matter for a default hearing. Approximately a month before the default hearing, the mother filed a document which the parties treated as a motion to set aside the default, and in that pleading, she also requested that the court appoint her counsel. At the hearing, which was originally set for the default hearing, the district court mother appeared telephonically without an attorney. The district court heard her argument relating to setting aside the default, did not find that argument convincing, and declined to set aside the default. The court did go ahead and appoint counsel for mother and reset the default hearing about another month and a half down the road. At the default hearing, the department presented the testimony and evidence relating to the grounds in the termination petition against the mother, and the court found clear and convincing evidence that the mother's rights should be terminated and did go ahead and enter an order terminating her parental rights. Initially on appeal, the mother argues that the district court did not have subject matter jurisdiction to hear the termination action because of allegations that somehow in the juvenile proceeding the department's policies and procedures were not followed when shelter care was taken of the minor child. The Supreme Court reiterated that subject matter jurisdiction with respect to a termination is invoked with the filing of a complaint, stating that the case belongs to a general class over which the authority of the court extends. And in a footnote indicated that the district court's subject matter jurisdiction in a termination action is separate from the issue of the children's shelter care placement within the juvenile court proceeding. The Supreme Court went on to say that the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure do apply to termination proceedings. They are civil actions. And more specifically, Wyoming Rule of Civil Procedure 55 relating to defaults applies to termination proceedings. The court then discussed how Wyoming Rule of Civil Procedure 55 operates in conjunction with the termination statutes, discussed again, which has been discussed in other cases, more specifically the In Re Zemetz case. The type of process that might be used in a default hearing when it is with respect to a termination case, and indicates that a court can only proceed to disposition on the default when the department establishes the requisite factors for termination set out in the statute by clear and convincing evidence. In other words, there cannot be just an entry of default with no hearing held and with no evidence presented relating to the grounds in the petitions. And the court indicated that the statutory requirements that the court and the department are required to follow satisfy the due process clause requirements that safeguard a parent's fundamental liberty interest in maintaining a relationship with his or her child. The court then went on to discuss the failure to set aside the entry of default and found that the district court did not abuse its discretion in failing to set aside the entry of default. Found that if the defaulting party cannot provide reasons for setting aside the entry of default, then it necessarily follows that good cause under Wyoming Rule of Civil Procedure 55C cannot be established. That ties into Wyoming Rule of Civil Procedure 60B, which sets forth various grounds for relief. The court found that there are three factors to be looked at in determining whether a default should be set aside. One, whether the plaintiff will be prejudiced. Two, whether the defendant has a meritorious defense. And three, whether culpable conduct of the defendant led to the default. The court then applied that three-factor test to this particular case and again found that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the mother's motion to set aside the default. Then the last issue on appeal related to the sufficiency of the evidence to support the termination. The district court did take judicial notice of the juvenile proceedings in this matter. One other issue on appeal that the appellant raised was that because those files were not made part of the record on appeal, that the absence of those records renders the evidence insufficient. The Supreme Court pointed out in a footnote that it is up to the appellant to designate an adequate record for review to the Supreme Court, and because the appellant did not bring those documents forward, they could not complain with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence with respect to those documents. The court then determined that there was clear and convincing evidence relating to at least the first ground in the petition, which was Wyoming Statute 14.2309A4, that the parent is incarcerated due to the conviction of a felony and that the parent is unfit. And because the court concluded there was sufficient evidence on that ground, they did not discuss the claim that there was insufficient evidence on the other ground in the petition. I also am going to discuss the next case. It is in the interest of S.O., and the site is 2016 Wyoming 99. This was an October 2016 case. And this case was an appeal from grandparents. Grandparents had intervened in a juvenile court proceeding, and the juvenile court did allow that intervention. The grandparents then, at various points in time in that juvenile proceeding, requested placement of the minor child involved in the proceedings from the foster home where the child was placed in to the grandparents, and finally filed a specific motion seeking to transfer placement of the child from the foster parents to the grandparents. The juvenile court declined to change the placement of the minor child, and so the issue before the Supreme Court was whether the juvenile court abused its discretion when it denied the motion for placement made by the grandparents. Without getting too deep into the factual background, the grandparents had, at the beginning of the juvenile case, been sent notice that the child was in the department's custody and provided an opportunity to indicate whether they wanted to be a placement for the child. At that time, they did not indicate they wanted to be a placement, although they did indicate they wanted to be involved in the child's life. After the permanency plan in the juvenile court changed to adoption and the matter proceeded to termination against the mother, the grandparents then raised the issue that they wanted to be a placement of the child. The Supreme Court said that the guiding principle of Wyoming's Child Protection Act is that a child's health, safety, and welfare shall be a paramount concern in implementing and enforcing the Child Protection Act, and that thus at its core a juvenile court's decision regarding placement of a child must be based on the child's best interest. The court then, grandparents argued based on the JW case that basically simply because they were the grandparents of the minor child that the child had to be placed with them. The Supreme Court disagreed with that, then provided an analysis of the best interests of the minor child, and discussed the compelling preference for placement with relatives when possible, but quoted the district court or acknowledged that there is a preference for family placements in Wyoming, but held that the preference for family placement should not prevail over the paramount concern for the best interest of the child. Then determined that the juvenile court determined it was in the best interest of the child to remain placed with the foster parent, that it was in the court's discretion to make that determination, and that the evidence demonstrated the reasonableness of the decision of the juvenile court to make that determination. So this case is kind of a little bit of a sea change from how that relative placement has been seen in earlier case law. But again, reiterating that in juvenile court actions, we are looking at the best interests of the minor child.
And so the next case from 2016 that we want to talk to you about is in the matter of the guardianship of M.K.H. And this case involves a guardianship that a grandmother requested guardianship of her granddaughter. The request for guardianship was made prior to the birth of the granddaughter. The child was to be born within the next 6 weeks of the filing of the petition. The mother was incarcerated at the time of the filing of the petition and expected to be incarcerated for a period of time. Both the mother and father of the unborn child did provide consent to the court to the appointment of the grandmother as the guardian, and ultimately an order was entered back in 2005. And so a little bit of factual slash procedural history on that. 2005, the order is entered granting grandmother guardianship of her unborn granddaughter effective immediately. at some point in the proceedings, the paternal aunt moves to set aside the order of guardianship based on the fact that she has the child, some of the child's siblings, and wants to keep them all together. In 2006, the grandmother's guardianship is extended through an order, and then things apparently are quiet for approximately 6 years, when in 2012, dad moves to terminate the guardianship. There's no indication what happens to that, but in 2014, dad files an additional petition to vacate the initial order of guardianship from 2005. Then in 2015, dad files a 12B1 motion based on lack of subject matter jurisdiction by the court in entering the 2005 guardianship. 2016 is when a decision is made and there is an order by the district court that grants dad's motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And the district court's basis for vacating the 2005 order was that the order indicates that the guardianship became effective immediately. And at that time, the child had not been born yet. And so The district court determined that the definition of the definition of minor provided for in the statute did not include the fetus, and so the grandmother is the one who appealed the district court's determination that that 2005 order should be vacated due to lack of subject matter jurisdiction by the court at the time that it was entered. Procedurally, the Supreme Court did view, although the father brought his motion as a 12B1 motion, and that's what the district court ruled upon, the Supreme Court did view the court's order more akin to a Rule 60B4 order setting aside a judgment as void for lack of jurisdiction. And so under their standard of review with regard to Rule 60B, did provide then that they were looking whether or not the matter was within the discretion of the trial court and limited to their review to whether or not there was an abuse of discretion. And so again, another instance for the Supreme Court to interpret or provide statutory interpretation to get us to our answer. And so again, the district court had originally held that the 2005 guardianship order was void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction because it did appoint grandma as guardian of the baby before the baby had been born. And so the Supreme Court did acknowledge that, there was some doubt as to the district court's intent as it related to that 2005 order, specifically that it to impose, whether there was an intent to impose the guardianship over the baby, before her birth. And the court does provide a footnote that sort of practically discusses some of the issues that could arise from that. What remains was the language of the order did make the guardianship effective immediately, which was a date that clearly preceded the child's birth, and there was no limit on the scope of the guardianship as it pertained to the child's unborn status. So the Supreme Court did, the first question that they addressed was whether the Wyoming's guardianship statutes authorized the court to appoint a guardian for an unborn child. And so again, in looking at whether or not we can have a guardianship over an unborn child, the Supreme Court does acknowledge that guardianships are controlled and governed exclusively by statute, which again required the Supreme Court to interpret the statute. And so in looking at this question of whether or not an unborn child is a minor, the Supreme Court did determine that based on the statutory definition of that term, the answer is no. And they did look, directly to the guardian statutes defined the term minor to mean an unemancipated individual under the age of majority as defined by Title 14, 14.1-101. And so the Supreme Court did agree with the district court's reasoning that the definition of minor in the guardianship statutes is meant to distinguish between adults and children and has no meaning with respect to an unborn child. And so ultimately then, because the guardianship statutes do not authorize the appointment of a guardian for an unborn child, the district court erred in appointing a guardian for MKH before her birth. However, the Supreme Court went on to further indicate that that does not necessarily follow that the district court was without jurisdiction to act in this matter or that the 2005 order was void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And so the Supreme Court then continues in its opinion with discussing subject matter jurisdiction and you know, indicating certainly that there are some concerns, you know, with challenging a final order so long after its entry and when time for appeal has passed, and certainly balancing that with the question of subject matter jurisdiction being able to be raised at any time. So the Supreme Court was concerned in this case as to whether the district court acted outside its jurisdictional authority in entering the 2005 order, or if the district court merely erred in its exercise of its lawful jurisdiction. And so if it was the former, if the district court had acted outside their jurisdictional authority, the Supreme Court would declare the order void. However, if they had merely erred in exercising its lawful jurisdiction, the order would stand. And so through the analysis, the Supreme Court did ultimately find that with respect to this issue, there was no question that the district court could have, in the order, specifically identified that the guardianship was to take effect upon the child's birth. And so the court's error in entering the 2005 order was its failure to delay the effective date of the order. And so based on that discussion and interpretation by the Supreme Court, an error in the effective date of the guardianship appointment did not rise to the level of a jurisdictional effect. And so the district court had jurisdiction to act on the petition, and it simply erred in its exercise of that jurisdiction. So the voiding of the order was overturned by the court and found to be effective just with a delayed effective date instead of effective immediately, effective upon the birth of the child. And so, again, the big takeaway from this case is that an unborn child is not included in the definition of minor, and a court may not appoint a guardian for an unborn child. However, in this particular case, the error was with regard to the effective date of the appointment, and the Supreme Court did not find that rose to the level of a jurisdictional effect. And so the 2005 order did remain in effect as it related to the mother's guardianship, or the grandmother's guardianship.
Right. This is Jill again. The next case we're going to discuss is In the Interest of RAA. It is 2016 Wyoming 117. This was issued in December of 2016. This case relates to a termination of parental rights action and what I call, because I represent the agent, a private termination of parental rights action. So this would be an action that a mother brought against a father to terminate his parental rights. The ground in the termination petition was under Wyoming Statute 14.2309A1, that the child was left in the care of another without contact and without support from the parent for a period of 1 year. The district court did grant the petition to terminate parental rights, but the Supreme Court reversed the decision of the district court, focusing on the requirement related to communications or contact with the children. And the Supreme Court determined that under the facts of the case, the contacts that the father had with the children were not incidental. The court did kind of hone in on 14.2309A3, providing that there are three elements within that ground, or three areas. Number one, that the child has been left in the care of another. Number two, without contact. Number three, without support, again, for a period of 1 year. In this particular case, the father had been incarcerated for quite some period of time, but during the time he was incarcerated, he had sent over 40 letters and cards to his children. When he was released from incarceration, He then attempted to establish contact with the children and, in fact, filed after being told he would not be allowed contact by the mother, had filed a petition to establish visitation. In response to that petition, the mother filed the petition to terminate the father's parental rights. The court looked to the definition of incidental, indicating that incidental, as used in the statute, is a casual minor occurrence that is insignificant and of little consequences. But the court did say it that there can be intentional communications that can be considered incidental, just as those that happen by chance. Because of the fact that the father continually tried to communicate with his children over the period of several years, and given the amount of letters and cards that the father had attempted to send to the children, the court stated the father did just enough to avoid satisfying the statutory requirements, meaning that he did just enough to show that it was more than incidental contact. Edie, I don't know. We are at the end of the 2016 cases, but we do have four 2017 cases to discuss. We are obviously not going to get through those cases, and so I'm wondering how you want to proceed. And as we've discussed in the past, there will be more decisions in 2017 coming in the near future.
Yeah, Jill, this is Edie. I think we can break now, and if anybody has any questions about the 2016 cases you've reviewed, please send your questions in through the chat line or call in. And then what we'll plan to do is set up a separate Blog Talk Radio episode just specifically dedicated to 2017 decisions, and hopefully we'll be able to have that maybe even the next couple weeks. But the handout that was provided as part of today's presentation does include the four cases from 2017. So if you're anxious to learn about them, they are outlined in the handout. So are there any questions about the cases that Jill and Christina have reviewed so far? We do have one question that's come in on the chat line. Can they give us the sites for the 2017 cases? Jill or Christina, would you mind just saying the names and the sites to those four we didn't get to, pretty please?
No, that's fine. The first one is 2017 Wyoming 2. It is in the matter of the termination of parental rights to KGS, and it is that companion case to that earlier HLL case. The next one, and that case was decided in January of 2017. The next one is In the Interest of NP. It is 2017 Wyoming 18. This is an appeal from an adjudication in the juvenile court, and it was decided February 27th, 2017. The next one is In the Interest of JB and TLW minor children. It is 2017-26. It was decided on March 7th, 2017. And it is an appeal, again, from an adjudication of neglect. And the last one is In the Interest of DT and NT. It is 2017 Wyoming 36. It was issued April 5th, 2017, and this is an appeal from a permanency hearing in a juvenile neglect action.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jill and Christina. And like I said earlier to everybody on the phone, we'll try to at least schedule a 30-minute Blog Talk Radio presentation in the next couple of weeks to hit those 2017 cases. So thank you to everybody that tuned in today. And Jill and Christina, any parting comments?
No, just as I said, we have two cases right now that we're waiting for a decision on, and then there's a private termination that's on appeal as well, where there will be a decision, and then we have, I think, I'm going to say 6 other appeals that are in various stages of the process. So 2017 will be a fairly busy year for case law in our area.
All right. Well, thank you again, and thank you to everybody that tuned in, and we will catch you all during the next Blog Talk episode. Thanks again, Jill and Christina.
Thank you.
Bye.